The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It is a great privilege to be here. Thank you for your time this evening. I am here to talk about A Brief History of Doom. You see the cover right there. This is a book that examines 43 major financial crises that occurred in the six largest countries in the world over the last 200 years. In the U.S. alone, that was 1819, 1837, 1857, 1873, 1884, 1890, 1907, 1929, 1987, and 2008. It's a very busy subject area. We also developed, through a lot of original research, we reconstructed a lot of data, especially private debt data, around each of these 43 crises and put them out on a website for the academic community to have availability for future research. So here's the pattern. This is private debt in the United States as a percent of GDP from 98 to 15. The blue bars here are the ratio of private debt, that's business and personal debt, to GDP, and GDP is basically income. So it's the old banker's ratio of debt to income. Between 2002 and 2007, it skyrocketed from 140% of GDP to 170% of GDP. Most of that was a doubling of household mortgages from $5 trillion to $10 trillion in just a few short years. This is subprime loans, but it was also cash out mortgages. It was fix and flip. It was all of the above. And what you see here is a chart that I could put up for pretty much all 43 of the crises. It's a pattern. It is rapid debt accumulation that leads to overcapacity, too much of something, usually real estate, housing, and office buildings. And because you've got too much of something, the loans go bad, so you have a plethora of bad debt, and that leads to the failures of banks or the need to rescue those banks. That's the paradigm. That's the pattern. It's pretty much always the same. So let's look at a few. Here is the 1830s in the United States, and the blue bars here are land sales, federal land sales in the United States. They went from 2 million acres a year in 1831 to 24 million acres by 1836. That's more land that was sold that exists in the entire country of Britain, sold in less than a decade. It was pretty much all debt financed. It was mostly speculation. In a city like Chicago, which was barely established and only had a few thousand people, the price per acre of land went from $32 an acre to $13,000 an acre in a few years. That was almost as much as land cost in Manhattan. Onlookers described it as a riotous carnival. It was more land and more building construction than could possibly be productively used. It had to come to an end, came to an end when a cantankerous president named Andrew Jackson stopped land from being able to be bought on debt. He did something called the Specie Circular that said if you're buying federal land, you basically better have gold or silver. And it all came crashing down. If he had not done that, it would have been some other mechanism sooner rather than later. So here let's look at, This is a chart that goes from 1800 to 1914. The blue bars again are federal land sales, and you can see it's not a smooth distribution of land sales through the century. It is big spikes, big bursts in land sales. The black line is railroad track miles constructed. And again, it's not a smooth progression. It is spikes. And often what you see is the land spike boom and the railroad construction boom happen, of course, at exactly the same time. All these booms led to busts because each of them represent the construction of way more railroads than were needed at that moment, far more than passenger volumes and freight volumes would justify. And by the way, railroads are not just any old business in this century. Railroads were the 800-pound gorilla of the U.S. economy in the 1800s. Railroads represented over 50% of all the private debt loans made in that long stretch. Railroads represented over 60% of the market value of the New York Stock Exchange through most of this period. There's no single industry today that constitutes more than about 20%, and railroads were 60%. So it was the railroad boom and bust century. Now here's a tale from one of these crises that shows that lenders, financiers, have always been creative. This is not something that just happened recently. Railroads were capital hogs. They needed a lot of capital, and it was hard to raise. So some folks in Wisconsin had the bright idea to sell farmers common stock with dividends in those railroads. The farmers along the right-of-way. The railroad was very helpful. It arranged for a bank to make the loan to the farmers because the farmers didn't have money to buy this stock. It required no money down on these purchases of stock. Sound familiar? It even provided the appraiser to appraise the value of the land. No conflict there, right? The dividend on the stock paid the interest on the loan. All the farmer had to do was pledge his or her farm as collateral for the loan. You see what's about to happen? Every one of these crises, there was an egregious departure from sound lending practices. There's 43 of them. It was never subtle. They're always blatant departures, just as in 08. They were making no money down mortgages and not checking income. So here's the big one, the Great Depression. Now, historians tend to neglect the period before 1929. They tell the story of the crash, folks jumped out of windows, and then we had a bad decade after that, right? Here's the real story. There was an essentially unprecedented increase in construction spending in the Roaring Twenties. The level of spending, which mainly was on housing, was four times greater than it had been in the previous decade. There was massive overbuilding in housing in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Florida, of course, we hear about that one, and many, many more cities. It wasn't just housing. It was also skyscrapers. Here you see the blue bars are the number of skyscrapers built in New York over the past century. And you can see where the circle is. Those are the office buildings built in New York in the 1920s. Greater than any subsequent period. And they were built without reference to the need or tenant demand. When the Manhattan Trust Building and the Chrysler Building were vying with each other to be the tallest building in town, they were adding floors after construction had begun. Then along came the Empire State Building and Rockefeller Center. These buildings would not have be full of tenants for decades because there was never demand to begin with. They were all debt financed. Let me give you some specifics. Here's Fred French, who invented the French plan for financing dividend-paying equity and selling it to the man on the street in the early and mid-20s. He used a series of advertisements and a battery of 150 salesmen and offered the man with $100 to invest the same terms as the man with $1,000. Here's the punchline. The demand for these bonds was so great that bond houses were actively seeking out real estate developers to show them how to build a building without any capital on their part. In other words, none of this was driven by need. It was all driven by the availability of large pools of money. The mid to late 20s witnessed a sensational period of urban speculation that was referred to as the seventh wonder of 20th century commerce. Now, it was mainly real estate, but it was not all real estate. There was one other major area of lending and speculation, and that was utilities, which were the go-go internet-like industry of the 1920s. And the king of them all was Samuel Insull and Commonwealth Edison. Insull had actually been an assistant to Thomas Edison, and he built up a magnificent utility industry or company, but he took it too far. They did what we call nowadays a roll-up of other utilities over a span of 32 states. Almost all of this was through leverage rather than equity. Here's a quote from Insull's 1950 biography. At a party, the new president of the Continental Bank, now Commonwealth Edison, which was his company, was in Chicago, and that's where Continental Bank was, sidled up to Insull's son and said, "Say, I want you to know that if you fellows want to borrow more than the legal limit, all you have to do is organize a new corporation, and we'll be happy to lend you another $21 million. You know, that's probably a couple hundred million in today's terms. Insull's bookkeeper said, the bankers would call us up and ask, "Say, isn't there something you could use maybe $10 million for?" The situation had the impact of three stiff drinks on an empty stomach. It captured the spirit of the lenders of the age. Of course these stocks got overvalued. Of course they came crashing down. Insull died penniless and disgraced. And by the way, he's the little man from the Monopoly game, in case you were wondering. I've gotten a lot of feedback from readers, so I'll finish talking about the 30s with one more comment. This came from a reader who said, "I grew up in Asheville, North Carolina, where the real estate bust happened in 27, and not a single new building went up downtown for the next 40 years. Like some other places, properties were available for the back taxes. Given that 9 of the 10 banks never reopened after the bank holiday, things were pretty drab until the last 20 years. Some people liked it that way, though." That brings us to what perhaps is my favorite, the 80s Reagan and Thatcher debt boom. A lot of folks look back on the 80s fondly, but if you go and look back at what actually happened, it was perhaps the most crisis-laden decade, certainly one of the most crisis-laden decades we've ever had. There was an S&L crisis where over 800 S&Ls failed, a bank crisis where over 2,000 banks failed, a commercial real estate crisis, an oil lending crisis when oil prices collapsed in 86, a Latin American debt crisis, which almost took the New York Money Center banks down, a junk bond crisis, remember Michael Milken, an ag lending crisis, if you go to Iowa and Nebraska, is still one of the defining events in their history. It was all built on runaway lending. For Reagan, private debt increased by more than 20% in 5 years, which is a dangerous threshold. For Margaret Thatcher, it was even more. Private debt to GDP, which you see at the bottom here, doubled during her tenure. It led to all the calamity of the early 90s. But Thatcher and Reagan exited just as it was beginning to unravel, and it was left for the hapless George H.W. Bush and John Major to bear the blame. And of course, Bill Clinton came in, limiting H.W. to one term, reminding us that it's the economy, stupid. So let's talk about 07. In the summer of 07, consumers had reached a record high net worth. The stock market had reached a record high. Consumer confidence was near a record high. My favorite of all, banks were contributing historically low loan loss contributions, which told us they thought things were sanguine. And yet, by 2005, at least a year and a half earlier, the crisis was baked in. The crisis was certain by the end of 05. We see this on the chart where the blue bars are housing sales, pretty much all of them debt financed. By the end of 05, pretty much all of the subprime debt loans, the cash out real estate loans, the mortgage excess had already occurred. It kind of tells you that you shouldn't be paying attention to the earlier indicators I mentioned, and that the acceleration of private debt itself is the best indicator. So I'm going to conclude by repeating the pattern, which is that widespread excessive lending brings overcapacity when results in excessive bad loans, which bring widespread bank and lender failure or need for rescue. It's never, by the way, government debt that brings these crises. The stock market collapses are something that happens after the excess occurs and are a result rather than a cause. If there's any comfort, it's that if you know what to look for, these crises are easy to detect. It is always runaway lending, which we can dimension mathematically, and it's always an egregious departure from sound lending practices. Thanks, folks.
Hello, everyone. So I'm Joe Torricella, Pennsylvania State Treasurer, and let me say at the outset, huge fan of Richard Vig. The Philadelphia Magazine, in a profile of him a couple of months ago, said he is a true Renaissance man and, quote, exactly the sort of person who should be president of the United States, which is an opinion I share, only I came to it earlier than they did, but glad to be here with them. And I also want to say at the outset that I really love the book. I should also tell you that my dog really loved the book. And she's not much of a reader, so this is high praise, actually. But it's the copy on which I took all my notes, so I'm going to keep it and treasure it. But Richard, your first book, which was mentioned, was The Next Economic Disaster and How You Can, What You Can Do About It. The second is A Brief History of Doom. Can we get a cheerful book out of you one of these days?
The biography of Joe Torricella, I think, is next.
Okay, so I'll take it. You write in the book towards the end that the question you get most often, which I'm sure someone would ask if I didn't, is what does your formula tell us about what's coming and where is it coming from? So, and for those of you who haven't read it, the formula, the pattern Richard talked about is actually more precisely defined of the exact level at which the level of private debt, not government debt, indicates that there's turbulence ahead. But can you share with us, look forward and tell us what does that imply for how we're going to do and what does that imply for the rest of the world?
Thank you, and let me quickly say before I answer
that we have with us the greatest Treasury Secretary in the history of the state of Pennsylvania. And we also have with us my lovely wife, Laura, who's been steadfast. Can you raise your hand, sweetheart? Who's been a steadfast partner of mine in putting this book together. So thank you, dear. We've kind of left the 18th century now, and we're in 2019, and my team and I are spending a lot of time looking at the top 20 countries in the world. And I think the good news for us is there's not major problems in the United States of America. There's a couple of pockets of problems. We think there's going to be a problem in ag lending. We think there's healthcare sector problems. We think HLT, or highly leveraged transactions, are going to be a problem. But these are all small sectors of the U.S. economy. We have major problems brewing in Asia. It's not just China, but Australia, South Korea, other satellites of China. And I think that could redound to the detriment of the rest of the world.
So just to read a couple of headlines from the last 3 months for the U.S. economy and on corporate debt. Fed issues more warnings on dangers of high-risk company debt. Fed's Powell flags corporate debt surge. Janet Yellen sounds alarm over plunging loan standards. Warren Buffett, this is not a headline, it's a quote, covenants are to protect debt holders have really deteriorated. Why doesn't that rise to the level that the 2008 subprime issues did?
This is very important. There is $31 trillion in private debt in the United States right now. Real estate is about $14 trillion of that $31 trillion. So if you have a problem in real estate lending, you got yourself a problem. You know, if 10% of real estate loans go bad, that's $1.4 trillion. And the banking system only has $2 trillion in capital in it. Highly leveraged transaction as a category is only $1 trillion. 10% of those loans go bad, it's $100 billion. The industry has $2 trillion in capital. So it's the size of the offending sector that's one of the very most important things to understand when assessing the potential of a crisis.
So to push back just a little, isn't it, in addition to size, isn't the issue also we don't really know the sort of knock-on impact of all these things? We don't know where all these loans live. I mean, you talk about it a little in the book, do we really know where the shadow banking sector is loaning money and what it amounts to? We have a decent idea of what the banking sector is doing. Do all of us actually have a good picture of what else is happening out there that might lead to your ratio?
You know, there's not as good information even in the United States as you would want. We can triangulate on most of it. We spend a lot of time on this subject. The one area that is kind of a wild card is derivatives. And right now, even after all we've been through, the federal government does not require banks to make full and complete disclosure of their derivative book. They can take those derivatives and put them in a deconsolidated foreign subsidiary. And, you know, we've tried to assemble this information around the world. The Bank of England won't give you derivative information on UK banks because of confidentiality agreements they've signed with those banks. So that's the one blind spot I worry about the most. And I don't think I have it fully dimensioned, but I kind of stand by what I said, which is the United States, we're going to have a few minor problems. We don't have a massive problem. Asia, you're going to have a massive problem.
So I will say that reading through the series of crises that you touched on, the peaks or the valleys of, it is really striking how similar they all sound and how predictable they look in retrospect. But I was startled by, early in your book, you say, the formula predicts almost all financial crises. And I think you said something like 80%. So tell us about the other 20%, and if that's enough to make you or us question how predictive this is.
Well, I think really what the issue is that there's some things that probably should be crises, but the government of that country intervenes to soften the blow in a dramatically successful way. So that's where the formula fails. It's not that we get crises that we don't see. It's that some things we think probably should be crises aren't. Let me give you a great example of this. In China in 99, the bad debt in Chinese banks has reached 30 or 40% of all loans made. If you know banking at all, you know that if you get to 3 or 4% bad loans in a bank, you probably have a problem. In China, it reached 30 or 40%. China used accounting ledger domain, if you will, to allow those banks to push off their bad loans at par into asset management corporations that the government itself guaranteed. So the banks got well almost immediately, and a crisis that should have happened by our prediction never happened because of an assertive government.
So if you're, what's been the reception in the kind of conventional economic community, which you note has missed most of these things? You also note they're pretty hard to miss if you know what you're looking for, that all these things you say, they're not even subtle. They're staring you in the face. Explain how economists have missed this and what's wrong in the way they're thinking about the world that we need to correct.
So the conventional economic profession does not even use private debt as a factor in their models. To this moment, the Fed, when it puts together its DSGE-based forecast of the economy, does not consider private debt. We could get into a long discussion of why that is, but the conventional industry doesn't focus on it. There's plenty of heterodox economists that do, though, and they're growing in number. The most encouraging thing that I can tell you, though, is that I have, by hook and by crook, in my wanderings on this subject, gotten linked up to a number of young, rising economists at places like Cambridge, England, Cornell, Princeton, Harvard, UCLA, Chicago, and elsewhere. These are the guys that were doing their dissertation while the crisis was occurring. So they knew that what they were inheriting from their department was not true. So there's what I would call like the next generation of economists who are going to be our leaders 10 or 20 years from now that I think believe what I've written in this book.
That's encouraging. I always remember the quote about economists, if you laid all the economists in the world end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion. But Richard, if I was trying to summarize this book to every American, sort of say what the kind of main message of it is, it seems pretty stark. It seems that it is that maybe not recessions, but cataclysmic financial events like 2008 and the Great Depression can be predicted. They can be avoided. We've let you down by not doing that. And we probably should forgive your debts. Is that, and that last part is a little deliberately provocative, but I think the takeaway, at least that I had, maybe not entirely stated, was without reducing debt levels, eventually we're going to head into this kind of territory. Is that an accurate, if kind of crude summary?
No, that's a terrific summary, and you're absolutely right. And it's even true today. We're continuing to look at this. That every major economy, even though kind of the immediate crisis is past, it is still true that the ratio of debt, especially private debt, to GDP is continuing to grow over time. That's an inherent structural element of modern economies that, if you reflect on it, is deeply troubling. So yeah, there's something needs to be done.
So. Is part of the something that we should forgive X category of debt? You reference in the book this idea of a jubilee. Talk a little about that. How, if you were king for a day, how would you do it?
Well, it's clear to me that the cleanup after the fact should include some kind of debt restructuring for households that was not done. And let me put a dimension on it. There were 52 million mortgages in 2009. Probably 15 million of those were what we would call significantly underwater. that the principal balance was 15%+ in excess of the value of the home. These are folks that have been struggling ever since that moment. They got saddled with too much debt for all sorts of reasons. And these are the folks that haven't bought new cars, haven't taken vacations. And by the way, a healthy number of these folks are the ones that, in throwing up their hands, voted for Trump. Steve Bannon points to these folks for whom no relief was given and says that was our core voters in this last election. You know, we put forward a lot of ideas, and all these ideas are difficult. But let me give you an example. In 82, the New York banks had bad debt to lesser developed countries that was equal to 176% of their capital. If the examiners had come in 82 and done examinations the proper way, remember all the lending that was done to Latin America in the 70s? The money center banks in New York would have been shut down. Paul Volcker, new to office, 3 years in office, brought him into a room and said, we're not going to look at your LDC debt for the next several years when we come in and examine you. We're not going to deduct it from your capital, even though it's bad. Go out there and build up your reserves so that a few years from now we can come in and you can write it off without failing. And that's what the New York banking industry did. Remember the Citibank's 87 announcement of a $3 billion reserve contribution? That was what they had put together over the 4 years since Volcker got them. There are ways to let time work in your favor. So in that spirit, I would say we should have gone to the folks that had underwater mortgages and said to the banks, if you restructure with those individuals, we'll let you write that off over 20 years instead of immediately. They would have had lower mortgages, and in trade, those folks should have then given the lender half the proceeds of the house when it ultimately got sold, a due on sale clause. Some idea like that would have given relief to 10 to 15 million households at a moment when they needed it greatly. It would have changed in a very positive way the trajectory of the recovery. It was an idea that no politician would entertain seriously. It's a controversial idea. Those are the kinds of ideas we're going to need, though.
So I want to come back to 2008 and how we responded, but stick with this for a moment. The student debt figure now, I think, dwarfs credit card debt as a percentage of the pie. In Pennsylvania, we used to be number one. We're now number two, which I suppose is progress. Is the idea of forgiving that tranche of debt in whatever way you devise, would that have any impact? Is that worth doing now, or do you think the ship has sailed and it doesn't apply?
My wife and I just spent a lot of time crisscrossing the country talking to folks all throughout America about things just like this. And I was not prepared to learn how pervasive the student debt problem is. I thought there'd be some 20-year-olds in my groups that would complain about student debt, and that would be about it. It was a big problem for 30 and 40 and 50 and 60-year-olds in every group of folks we talked to. I was taken aback. A lot of these folks had not paid off their own student debt and yet were being asked to co-sign on their children's student debt. It's a pervasive problem in a way that I was not expecting. I think there are creative ways to bring in some kind of debt forgiveness there. My own idea, for example, would be if you've made 10 years worth of payments and you've contributed 1,000 hours of community service, your debt should be forgiven. That's one way that has an element of fairness to it, but brings relief, gives a light at the end of the tunnel to people.
So tell me what your 20-year-ago banker self would have thought of that idea, and talk about how this book has changed your thinking in general.
Well, of course, when I was a lender, which I was for much of my career, you know, you just took it as a given that, you know, folks should honor their debt obligations, and, you know, that was that, and bankruptcy laws should be strict, and that sort of thing. So my research, I think, has changed, given my perspective on that. But I would tell you, even back then, if a regulator had walked in, I had regulators in my office all the time. So, you know, we got large enough to where we had a regulator in our offices basically 250 days a year. So, you know, there was no thing that you did without awareness of regulators. If I had had a problem, which we always had a problem in some pocket of the bank, right? If it wasn't over here, it was over here, you know. And you were, as a CEO, you were always trying to figure out ways to, you know, craftily, you know, fix the problem over here while nobody noticed, right? That's what you do when you're a CEO. So I can give you the handbook, by the way. So if a regulator had come into me and said, we know you have this problem over here, we're going to give you a dispensation to deal with it, I would have leapt at it. So I don't think from that perspective I would have felt differently back then.
So one of the recurring themes in your book is that the misbehavior, although always fundamentally the same, takes a different shape each time in ways you can't predict. Can we regulate sufficiently to stay ahead of this, or is that a fool's errand and we should look to other more kind of global measures like deleveraging?
Well, you know, you see a lot of this. You know, folks studied, you know, mortgage-backed securities ad nauseum after the crisis, as if we had comprehensive knowledge of MBS, we could have written a law that prevented that abuse in the future. Or capital requirements. You know, they came up with ways to make sure that the banks kept a lot of capital. Well, there's 1,000 lawyers, if not 100,000 lawyers, that are smart enough to figure out a way around anything that you can construct. I know, because I was one of the guys trying to figure out a way around those kind of prohibitions when I was a banker. What you can't hide are the aggregates. So I think it is useful to try to construct ways that require banks to keep more capital. But I think that's not a fail-safe. What is a fail-safe is watching the aggregates, and when debt grows too rapidly, to go in and lift the hood and see what's really going on.
So you just mentioned, you know, this. I thought reading the book that in some ways it was a lot about economics, but it was maybe even more a book about psychology. You kept coming back to this idea of ambition really being at the root of this, that lenders compete like the rest of us, and they are incentivized to make more loans, which then incentivize or create asset value inflation, which then creates this cycle. And you kept coming back to this idea that there's sort of ambition at play, and even talked about it in different fields. You also talked a lot, I thought, about how lobbying manages to keep, you know, big important pockets of this out of being properly regulated. Talk a little about this idea that in the end, this is sort of a problem of human nature that we need to face as much as a political economic problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every single day that I went to work as a banker, I had one objective, and that was how to increase loans. And just like, you know, if you're a coach in the NCAA, every day you go in to think about how to win basketball games, or if you have a computer company, every day you go in and think about how you can sell more computers. The instinct is no different. However, the industry is different. Banking is in fact unique because banks alone, among private institutions, can create money out of thin air. That's what banks do. When you make a loan, you deposit money into someone's account that didn't exist before you make the loan. And so in this crisis, we created $5 trillion of excess money. So there's a responsibility that accrues to banking that doesn't exist for an NCAA coach or a computer CEO. And that's the critical difference.
So on that note, we're going to go to audience questions. I was going to ask Richard to evaluate our response to 2008, but hopefully someone out there will as well. There's a microphone that will come to you if you raise your hand, and then we will take them one by one.
Fascinating. But how does public debt fit in and correlate with the private debt?
What you normally see, this is not always true, but what you normally see is that public debt grows rapidly after the crisis. And that's because two things happen. Because of the crisis, you know, the government has built up its expenses because, you know, what happens in these crises is government debt usually gets better in the crisis because things are so good, companies are paying more taxes. So in Spain, in the 5 years prior to their 2009 crisis, Spain's public debt to GDP profile improved by 13%. Government thinks it's a miracle and that they figured it out and the government takes credit for it. Then what happens is they've built up their expenses and taxes plummet. So suddenly they're faced with huge deficits, and they also, in the modern world, have the imperative to infuse the system with stimulus spending. So those two things mean that public debt grows very rapidly after the fact. But we can't find a single instance for developed countries. I'm not talking about Trinidad and Tobago. The rules are very different for small countries. For established countries, you can't find an instance where public debt led to a financial crisis.
I really enjoyed the book. I think it's an important book. Sadly, I don't think it's going to change anything. Human nature being what it is. I'll get to a question shortly. The thing that is so sad is that we talked about student loan problems. Today, student loans are being made. Tomorrow, they're going to be made. Next week, they're going to be made. And it doesn't take anything more than common sense and elementary school arithmetic to know if a loan is going to be good, and yet they continue to be made. So the question I have is, while you say that there is no imminent sign of economic turmoil because of the segmentations, and there's not one segment right now that is large enough to cause an economic catastrophe, there is an acceleration in bad stuff being done. Subprime auto, 7-year car loans, non-bank lending, Stripe, Square, PayPal, OnDeck, Cabbage, you name it, that are not regulated and maybe not calculated into the aggregate. So it seems that there's an acceleration of bad lending going on, which is, it just can't continue. So I'd like you to maybe talk about that, some of these new types of lending that are happening and maybe not being accounted for.
Well, you're absolutely right. Student debt has grown like a weed, a lot of it to for-profit schools that really we shouldn't be financing. A lot of folks' lives are going to be burdened and perhaps even ruined because of the student debt that's accrued. You've named the areas perfectly that are the pockets that will be problems. So we will have sector-based problems. A great example is the energy lending problem in 2016. Energy lending increased, you know, off the chain, as they say, between 2013 and 2016. We had huge problems. Write-offs of energy bonds and energy debt grew to greater than 10%. Happened in 2016. It affected that sector immensely. It didn't rise to the level of creating a national banking crisis. So you're right. We're going to have pockets of problems. I feel very concerned about ag in Iowa and Nebraska and lots of other places, and that crisis is about to happen. But there's a difference between the sector crisis and a national crisis.
Let's work our way around the room.
Thanks. See you next. My question is that tariffs were a big factor in the Great Depression, and that there's a lot of tariff problems now with the president, with our allies and China. How does that factor in to this, like, economic predictions?
Okay, I want to make a comment about tariffs in the Depression. Imports and exports in America in the 20s only amounted to about 3% of GDP. So My own analysis is, and so let's call that $1 billion in 1920 dollars in imports and exports. That compared to about $40 billion in bad real estate loans and utility loans. So in my mind, tariffs were a factor, but they were a tertiary factor. You know, it's not something that helps GDP. It's not something that helps anybody's economy. But it doesn't rise to the level of something that would create a crisis. So I think the Smoot-Hawley discussion that you hear a lot really doesn't jibe with the math of the crises. I'm not happy about what's going on today with tariffs. I would do it in a radically different way. I don't think Trump's approaching it properly. But it just exacerbates things at the margin rather than creates a crisis.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sursala, you asked a question about the forgiveness of the debt as a solution for the crisis in 2008. I'm wondering if the government bailing out AIG, the giant insurance company, was an alternative to the forgiveness of the debt. I'm saying this because I saw this firsthand. Here is what happened. The government bailed out AIG, and AIG paid the lender, and the lender took back their houses, and they left me, the homeowner, you know, with the stigma of with this very bad credit, and they took their houses back, and they put it back in the market with 50% of its actual value. I wonder if the government bailing out AIG was actually tricking the consumer, the taking us out of our right to forgive our debts, you know?
And Richard, I think this is a version of my critique, our response to 2008.
Yeah, the government acted relatively quickly to bail out large financial institutions, including AIG. And, you know, we all saw that. The government did not act directly to help households in any meaningful volume. I think that's at the heart of the populist discontent right now. We spent $1 trillion helping big institutions. There's a lot of bankers who were part of the problem that kept their jobs. Households didn't really get much in the way of relief.
In this century, do you feel that one party's view on regulation has affected the crises, since it seems that one party was in power before each of them?
Yeah, it's not always the case, but there's a whole lot of cases you see where the party, and I assume you're talking about the Republican Party, you know, went in to try to eliminate or suppress regulations. You know, a very famous example of that leading up to this crisis was regulations around derivatives. And Brooksley Bourne, who's one of my heroes, was head of the CFTC and wanted to introduce some common sense, even just record keeping around derivatives. You know, not even much regulation, just reporting around derivatives. And some of the big names in finance, including Larry Summers and others, and Alan Greenspan, pretty much told her no. You know, we saw it in the 80s when savings and loans were deregulated and allowed to enter the commercial banking realm without much supervision. And that helped lead to the excess of that period. One of my favorite stories that's actually in the book is about Charles Keating, who was, you know, violating every regulation you can think of, and retained Alan Greenspan to recruit a group of senators, which came to be referred to as the Keating Five, which included one of our recent presidential candidates and John McCain, and one of our astronauts, John Glenn, to basically go to the savings and loans regulators and tell them to leave Keating alone. So this is probably the rule rather than the exception in these crises, is the government gets co-opted to defend the misbehavior. And it's astonishing.
Well, you made the point that in one of these episodes, 30 bills were introduced to curb the bad lending practices, and because of lobbying, none of them passed. Surprise. But David.
Richard, you mentioned that the finance industry is unique because of its ability to create money out of thin air. Is a solution to this, or a possible solution to this pattern, to do away with fractional reserve banking? I think one of the Occupy working groups in the wake of the crisis was examining that.
I'm spending a lot of time thinking about this very subject. And by the way, David Gerson is one of a group of about six individuals that gave me very useful help at an early point in the draft of this book, and basically kicked me in the ass, excuse my language, and got me to improve certain things about the book to the benefit. So thank you. So, but at any rate, one of the things that I would note is that economies, it is impossible for a modern day economy to work without debt. Economies cannot grow without creation of debt. And that is one of the most underappreciated facts of modern economies. I think if you altered fractional banking, it would just have to pop up somewhere else. So that would be my critique of that prohibition.
Thank you both for being here. A question really about real estate as it relates to most of these crises. It appears that clearly in 2008, overabundance of subprime lending to, you know, no income, no asset, no job, borrowers. We know what happened after that. Today, perhaps it's an oversupply of, you know, multifamily. Who knows? There's an absorption issue there. But the lending requirements or the borrower requirements today are so much more robust than they were back then. But it seems that the harder it is to access capital today seems to not yet tamp down the abundance of lending, particularly to the real estate sector. Curious to know what you think about that.
You know, here's the problem, and that is the regulations that clamp down on lending relate to the biggest and most obvious types of financial institutions, so banks especially. That lending just goes outside the system when it's prohibited in the banking system. So it's going, you know, HLT is another example of this. If you can't do it in the banks, private equity will do it for you. And that's true in real estate and other things. So unless the regulators genuinely have the scope of responsibility to monitor these things inside and outside the industry, anywhere where there's a material amount of lending being done, you're going to have this issue of people figuring out how to sidestep the prohibitions.
We have time for one last question. Was your hand up here? Any others? Here.
How do you see uncertainty about next year's election and what the bankers have said about some of the Democratic candidates affecting what will happen next year in the financial sector?
So you're talking about potential regulation from some of the candidates that, you know, I got to tell you, I was an industry participant forever. I was involved in some of these lobbying efforts, and I know the tug of war that goes on. I think these big industries are big enough to take care of themselves. I'm not worried that somebody's going to come along and put so much prohibition on things that it's going to be damaging to the economy or anything like that. And it's a subject I've studied pretty carefully. I just think these big businesses can pretty much take care of themselves, even in the face of a regulation that, you know, might be viewed as restrictive.
On that note, I want to thank everyone for really good questions. Thank Richard for a great book.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.